When the child was 6 weeks old, he began to bleed from his navel. Doctors were called. They gave the Tsar and his wife the terrible news that their son Alexei, heir to the throne, had inherited the curse of haemophilia. That brought into the heart of the imperial family a semi-literate holy man from Siberia with, the child's hysterical mother believed, divine powers to keep her son alive. His name was Grigory Ifamovich Rasputin. And the great English historian Anthony Beaver has written a fabulous new account of his life, his power, and his death. The book is called Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs. And Anthony joins us now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Great to be with you, David.
What was that man's power? How was it that he came to exercise such authority over the imperial family?
Well, this is the fascinating question, because I don't think there's been any really similar example in history. We've had, for example, an éminence grise, but that was a cardinal controlling a French king. But we've never had a peasant, a virtually illiterate peasant from Siberia, in the case of Nicholas II and the Empress Alexandra, who achieved such influence and such power. And his effect was really to cause the collapse of the greatest autocracy we've ever known in the world. So from that point of view, it is an utterly unprecedented example, really, in history.
You crit this description of him a little in the book and say it's a little bit poetic, but this was a witness to the man who wrote about his soft, husky voice, his narrow and pale lips folded into a mysterious grin, the magnetic gaze of the pale eyes where one can momentarily see someone else, terrifying, powerful, lovingly beckoning you into the impenetrable jungle. He was obviously mesmerizing.
Well, he was mesmerizing, and he had this extraordinary effect on women. One has to remember that St. Petersburg society at this time, soon after the turn of the century, of the start of the 20th century, was obsessed with shamans, with spiritualists, and so forth. But also one has to remember that Russia, of course, was a very patriarchal society. Women were ignored coldly by their husbands. And so Rasputin appears, and he's the first man who, for many of these women, really actually seems to understand what women are about. And from that point of view, some started to throw themselves at his feet. Some, you know, volunteered to clip his fingernails, and then they would keep the clippings, which they would sew into their dresses as talismans. They would even take bits of half-chewed food from his plate and sew that into their dresses. I mean, it was astonishing the power that he did achieve over women.
There is this fabulous detail in the book where a witness says of him that he looked women in the eye and at his gaze they melted, but he wouldn't look men in the eye.
That is absolutely true. It's also one of the reasons why men, I think, also disliked him. Men, because, of course, Rasputin felt that he should address everybody in the same way, whether they were a princess or a chambermaid. And he would use the familiar version of speaking, of address. And the men felt that this was upsetting the social order in a bad way and resented it. But women, on the other hand, found this refreshing and new. And they also were not just taken over or hypnotized, if you like, by his gaze. It was also his voice, which was very deep and low and had a tremendous calming effect. And especially on children. And this is where I think that he first of all had this effect on the Tsarevich, the heir to the throne, who suffered from the haemophilia, but on other children too. So he did have an extraordinary influence and effect in this particular way. And he also did have other talents. One of them, of course, was this one whereby he had a power from his fingers. And, you know, he, in the case, actually, of Prince Yusupov, his killer, who had ingratiated himself with Rasputin as part of the plot to get him to come to the Moika Palace in St. Petersburg, where they were going to ambush him and then kill him. And Yusupov pretended that he had a bad back. And Rasputin used his fingers without touching the back at all, running the hands up and down, as I say, without touching, but would have this extraordinary effect.
Reiki massage, it's called these days, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, look, there's a triangle here. There is this holy man from Siberia, and there is an emperor and an empress. First, the emperor. You talk of him as being shy and obstinate and unconfident, and that those qualities would in the end undermine him.
They did indeed. He also had a terrible inferiority complex because of his height. Most of the Romanovs are all the Grand Dukes, and especially his cousin, the Grand Duke Nicholas, or Nicolasha, as he was known within the family, who was 6'7". And young Nicholas even confessed to a cousin, sort of saying, who is going to take orders from me, sort of a dwarf? So he had a terrible inferiority complex, which was, again, part of this obstinacy which developed later. And I fear that this is one of the, certainly one of the problems. The trouble was that this extraordinary couple, when I say extraordinary because they were such an unlikely pair in many ways, became sort of obsessively in love with each other. That was fine, and that in a way gave them strength. But it also meant that they cut themselves off from the outside world. And this was, I think, very, very dangerous when the Tsar and the Tsaritsa, the Empress, were supposed to be outgoing, they were supposed to entertain and all the rest of it. And this particular couple, these two, were much preferred to sort of wrap themselves up in their own rather bourgeois world, which of course encouraged the disdain and the resentment of the aristocracy in St. Petersburg.
And though the Empress was, in formal terms, German, you report that she was actually more English than anything.
Well, her mother died when she was still young, and her education, in fact, she was really became, in a way, not just the granddaughter of Queen Victoria, but sort of almost an extra daughter to her. And so was brought up at Windsor and at Balmoral. And of course, this really meant that when she arrived in Petersburg, she was rather lost in the sense that obviously she spoke German and English. Her French was bad, and she was actually sort of teased behind her back without realizing it to begin with. And of course, her Russian was not exactly very good. And so she was not taken very seriously by St. Petersburg society. But I think that was partly because of the shyness, partly because of the not just the lack of confidence, but also the way that she had no sense of humour whatsoever.
Yes.
And I think that this was a grave fault in her case.
It's a terrible drawback in anyone, Anthony, a terrible drawback.
Well, of course it is. It's an utter disaster. But especially, you know, if you are there as a member of a royal family and you wish to achieve a certain amount of following, of being liked and being able to deal with people. But this is the trouble. They had no imagination, these two, both Nicholas and Alexandra. As I say, wrapped up in their own particular world, they cut themselves off. And this, of course, was going to lead eventually to disaster, especially when they found that they needed a guru, if you like, because Rasputin in many ways was much more like a cult leader amongst his own particular entourage but also in the way I think that he dealt and in his influence with the imperial family.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the historian Anthony Beaver about his book on Rasputin. Anthony, how does he worm his way into the confidence of the imperial family?
Well, it's an extraordinary story of, shall we say, accelerated social climbing. Rasputin, having been a wanderer, a pilgrim, and this was quite a Russian phenomenon of literally living in rags and with chains around you, walking from place to place. And then he is in Kazan on the Volga, an old Tatar city, where he impresses a rich woman who has social contacts, and then she introduces him eventually to the local bishop, who then puts him in touch and is very impressed by Rasputin. And I think it's very important, perhaps at this particular point, to emphasize all of Rasputin's qualities and contradictions. I mean, he was both intensely spiritual, and yet he was utterly lascivious when it came to women. His way of seduction was really to invite women, which may seem rather a strange approach, but to take them with him to the banya, to the hot baths, where they were expected to wash him in a very intimate way, because he tried to persuade them, and this was his great seduction technique. You had to sin so as to be able to repent.
Wonderful idea. Oh, Anthony, what a wonderful idea. You must first fall before you can rise.
Well, he even came up with this theory that you needed to sin in the lower parts of your body or whatever.
That's right.
Release things in the upper part of your body. So it is amazing that anybody took that one particularly seriously. You would have thought that this was a rather obvious try-on, to put it mildly, but he certainly got away with it on numerous occasions.
No,
these contradictions, I think, are terribly important when you have, as I say, a genuinely spiritual side of Rasputin. And in a moment, he could switch to from lascivious to spiritual and vice versa, rather as that little piece you read out earlier of the way that he could change as a person. And he was also corrupt, but gave all his money away. He was paranoid and yet boastful. So, I mean, he was every possible contradiction. And actually, this is one of the things which fascinates one about him.
Yes.
Because it's very Russian. It's every single contradiction going, existing within the same person, rather as within the Russian character, you have both the European and the Asian. You have the Slavophil and the Westerner. All of these contradictions going together. And there's a great poet of the 19th century, Fyodor Tuchev, sort of said, you know, Russia cannot be understood with the mind alone.
Yes, there he is. And for the great benefit of historians like you, Anthony, he put a lot of people's backs up in St. Petersburg. And from quite an early time in his association with the imperial family, he was being trailed the entire time by secret police who were reporting on him. And these reports have survived. And so there is, as you have in the book, all of these accounts of him going on benders, of him seducing people, of him buying prostitutes, all of this kind of thing. But the important thing is that the Empress never believed a word of it.
Absolutely. She was convinced that all of this was an attempt to slander somebody who was basically a saint. And of course, her view of his sainthood comes entirely really with the, not curing, but with the his ability to ease the suffering of her son, the Tsarevich. Now, one's got to understand that the poor woman, there she was right from the start, under terrible pressure to produce an heir. She has four daughters, and then suddenly she has an heir born to great rejoicing, 120 gun salutes, and everybody thinks that the dynasty is safe, and then they find he has haemophilia. And when we see this great crisis, all the doctors, all the greatest doctors in the country, assume that the boy is going to die. And Rasputin rings and assures the empress that actually he's going to be all right and he will survive against all odds.
Don't let the doctors mess about with him.
Yes. Just leave him to recover himself.
It's a long-distance miracle.
It is a long-distance miracle. So one can understand it because if he is present, and the calming voice, the calming eyes, whatever it might be, has this effect. But here it is at long distance. And so the empress, when the boy recovers, the empress is absolutely convinced that he is a saint, that God is acting entirely through Rasputin. And so any report of misbehaving she absolutely rejects as pure jealousy and the way that saints have always been slandered and misrepresented.
So when Franz Ferdinand is assassinated at Sarajevo, Rasputin gives the emperor some bloody good advice, but he ignores it. Stay out of the war.
Rasputin knows perfectly well that in any war, it is always the peasantry in Russia who have suffered. And that is absolutely true. That is why he, first of all, opposed any involvement in the Balkan Wars. There were the two Balkan Wars shortly before the First World War. And, of course, this caused great anger and resentment, especially among the group around Nikolasha, the Grand Duke Nicholas, who was the commander-in-chief of the army, but also was married to the daughter of the King of Montenegro. And this had been the country most involved, really, in the whole idea of the Balkan War. So when the threat came of the First World War, yes, Rasputin and actually, of course, the Empress too, were against the idea. And that the Tsar himself realized the dangers probably to Russia. But he was really pushed into it, partly because of the pressure on the military side, but also this idea that their whole plan for mobilization depended not just on mobilizing against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it would also mean that they would have to mobilize because of the system. They would have to mobilize against Germany as well. And this was the disaster. But the crucial moment came, and Rasputin is then stabbed by a woman who is obviously obsessed with Rasputin and has been sent, in fact, by Rasputin's great enemy and rival, the hieromonk Iliador. This means that Rasputin is not in any position to influence events at the outbreak of the First World War.
At the very outbreak, but later.
At the very outbreak of the First World War.
But later, he's extremely influential in the decision of the Tsar to leave St. Petersburg and take control of the army, which leaves Rasputin and the Empress in charge of the government. And this is where things absolutely collapse, isn't it, Anthony?
It is indeed, yes. This was the fatal mistake. Everybody was horrified. The British and French, who were the allies of Russia against the Central Powers, the ministers, anybody who had any idea knew that Nicholas's desire to become the commander-in-chief, not out of any notion of grandeur necessarily, he felt it was his duty. And this was encouraged particularly by Rasputin and above all by the Empress, who felt that sort of it was his destiny to lead the armies in the field. And up until then, they also wanted to get rid of the Grand Duke Nicholas because they, and Rasputin and the Empress, began to believe, totally wrongly, that the Grand Duke Nicholas wanted to take over the throne himself.
Yes.
Which was not the case at all.
But isn't the lesson here an interesting lesson? that autocratic regimes can survive if they are good at choosing the people to do the political work for them, if they are good judges of character. And the problem yes. here was that Rasputin and the Empress were hopeless at it.
You're absolutely right. No, they were both disastrous judges of character in that particular way. And the trouble was that their priority for choosing governors, ministers, even prime ministers, was that they should be supporters of the Empress and of Rasputin, i.e. they were our friends, our supporters. And this meant that actually time after time, they chose the worst people possible. And it came to a disastrous state of affairs whereby they were changing them around time after time when somebody proved to be a disaster, and they'd choose somebody else who'd be just as bad. And this became known in the press even as ministerial leapfrog. And none of them were ever a chance to master their briefs, to take over and run their ministries effectively.
As Russia is gradually losing this mighty conflict. Now, we must get on to the death, because two aristocratic men decided that they would kill Rasputin. And it seems to me, particularly after reading the book, that this just brings all of the madness of Russia to bear. The assassins tell everybody what they're about to do, and then what they do goes horribly wrong. And it's great comedy, Anthony, I must say. It's in the bleakest possible way. It's great comedy. Why couldn't they just kill him easily and swiftly?
Well, they were incredibly incompetent, both in their plotting, as you rightly point out, the fact that they couldn't really keep it a secret, and they had sort of no idea really what they were doing. I mean, they formed a sort of little group. Prince Yusupov, who was married to the Tsar's favourite niece, the beautiful Grand Duchess Irina, and they were going to use her as the bait because of her famed beauty and all the rest of it. They were going to invite Rasputin to the Moika Palace, where they were going to kill him. And the whole idea was to kill him with poison. They were using arsenic, but it was either out of date or else they were putting it in sugary cakes, which actually would have reduced the effect of the poison.
Now, Anthony, let's not miss an important detail here. They were pretending to Rasputin that a party was going on, and for that purpose they'd set up a gramophone with a record. And they only had one record, so they were playing it over and over again during these proceedings. And the song was...
Yankee Doodle, indeed.
Yankee Doodle Dandy. So the Yankee soundtrack of the assassination of Rasputin was Yankee Doodle Dandy.
I agree. I mean, you
it's
know,
fabulous.
The lack of imagination that, you know, you're going to pretend to have a party and you keep on playing the same record and it's that one, it shows, shall we say, an incompetence which is hard to believe. Eventually, when they decide that they have to shoot him rather than the poison is not working, they shoot him, think they've killed him, leave the body, and then find that they haven't killed him. And when Yusupov goes back, he suddenly finds himself in this sort of deathly struggle with Rasputin. Rasputin then manages to escape even, and they have to chase him outside and then shoot him down. And, you know, to cover things up, because there's now blood on the snow, they then go and shoot the Borzoi wolfhound of Prince Yusupov to produce some blood. Again, that is an absolute disaster in its own particular way, because when the police start to investigate, they can find out straight away that actually it's not human blood, that it's a dog's blood.
Mm.
I mean, everything that can go wrong did go wrong.
And let's not forget, though they had carefully purchased chains and weights and identified somewhere in the river where there was a gap in the ice so they could weigh the body down, they threw the body into the river, forgetting to attach the chains and weights.
Yes, and not just that. They also found that they'd forgotten to chuck the boots, Rasputin's boots in beforehand, or at least rather to make sure that they were weighted down. So they just chucked the boots in, and of course they were found rather more rapidly, simply because they hadn't sunk. So, I mean, everything that could have been avoided or whatever, they managed to make a mistake over it.
This was in December 1916, and in February the revolution began. What was the impact of Rasputin on the revolution that brought down the Romanovs? How did he count in that great collapse?
Well, this is absolutely the key question, and in many ways the most important aspect of the whole book, because here one sees this fundamental paradox which completely upsets all the whole notion of the great man theory of history, because here we have Rasputin, the virtually illiterate person who's actually done more to bring down the whole of the Romanov autocracy. And this is because Rasputin, by his corruption, because he was involved in a whole lot of dubious things, which he didn't make really any money out of, which was sort of the contracts, supplying the underwear for the whole of the Russian army. Well, you can imagine how vast that was. But also the fact that the very idea that he had been sleeping with the Empress, because she'd become totally besotted with him, and of course rumours spread that he was even sleeping with the daughters, totally untrue. It was the fake news of the day. But all of this completely undermined the whole position of the Tsar, the fact that he was seen as a cuckold, that, you know, that his wife was actually sleeping with a peasant. And so when we see the street revolution of February 1917, there is not a single officer of the Imperial Life Guard regiments prepared to draw their sword in defence of the Romanov dynasty. And I think this sort of underlines more than anything that when a revolution takes place, it also comes about not because of the pressure from below, but also because of the collapse of confidence of the ruling regime and party.
Anthony, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Well, great to have been with you, David. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I've been talking to Anthony Beaver, British historian and author of this new book, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs. This is Late Night Live.